Thanks for joining us for the Executive Series. Today I'm speaking with Hamish Douglass, who is the Chairman and Chief Investment Officer of Magellan. Hamish, is it too late? I can at least wish you a happy Lunar New Year.
Well, Tom, happy Lunar New Year to you as well, and it's great to be with you again.
It's always great to chat. I was musing to myself ahead of our conversation that, you know, we saw the markets have an extraordinary rally at the end of last year. I think it was, for the S&P 500, it was one of the better improvements that we've seen since the 40s. In your thinking, how does that have you approach a new year when you've seen this extraordinary uplift for share markets around the world?
Yeah, it really is extraordinary, Tom, what's happened. It's understandable, but it is extraordinary, and it's extraordinary in a historical context. I think November was the single largest uplift in a month that we've seen in 47 years, you know, just to put it in context. And the question is, you know, how sort of risk being priced at the moment, how are we seeing sort of 2021? And the best I'd describe 2021 is the year of living dangerously. Because there's actually a whole series of issues at play at the moment that really makes markets, you know, both complex and dangerous. And there's very, very different outcomes depending on what actually happens ahead of us now. You know, I would say there's three broad scenarios ahead of markets. You know, we don't get any further material mutations in the vaccine that really go to the efficacy or really stopping people getting severely ill. And currently the vaccines are holding against the mutations we have at the moment. We get a rollout success around the world, and we get a very strong economic recovery as markets reopen and economies reopen, really at the latter part of this year and beginning of 2022. You know, you've got extraordinary monetary stimulus and fiscal stimulus around the world. And even in a historical context, it's kind of off the charts. We've got zero interest rates. So if we're reopening economies and there's just flood of money in the world, you can see why the market's rallied strongly. And you would actually say that is a world that's pretty constructive for asset prices. But you could have exactly the same scenario that the virus and the vaccines hold up here. But you could get a reversal of monetary policy through this strong economic recovery if inflation sort of rises its heads, and I'm sure we could discuss that. And that's not a pretty picture for asset classes, even in an economic recovery that looks super good. Rising interest rates or monetary policy changing course could be really negative for asset prices. And the third scenario is that we get further mutations of this virus that really challenge the vaccines that we've got here. And I would say that scientific risk, there's no pricing in markets for that at all at the moment. Whether it's going to happen or not happen, I'm sure we could have a discussion about that. We're doing an enormous amount of work on science. But the risk is well above 0% probability that we could get a very adverse turn in how this virus plays itself out. So, you know, you're at one end of the spectrum. It's kind of risk on. Virus is over. Economy's opening up. Bet on all the economic recovery. And that's what's really happened in the last few months. It's been an absolute risk-on play of historic proportions, as there was such relief when these vaccines were found in early November, and people are talking about more stimulus coming, particularly out of the United States. So you can see why people are getting enthused. They don't want to miss out on this. But as I said previously, it's kind of the year of living dangerously, because that's only one scenario that can play out here. And there's not a lot of margin for error in markets, either for a change in monetary policy, or I'd argue more worryingly, the virus taking a turn on mutations in scenarios that people aren't even contemplating at the moment.
Well, the gamut of things that you've just talked about there, Hamish, is quite substantial in terms of, you know, risk. So you mentioned the interest rate risk side of things. The central bankers around the world haven't even allowed themselves to form a thought of discussing a scenario where they raise rates. Have they painted themselves into a corner in relation to limiting that conversation and indeed opening the markets up for more risk?
Yeah, well, it is prisoner's dilemma. You know, I'm not being critical of them. I think that the situation we were facing in March and April was absolutely extraordinary of historic proportions. And, you know, they had to go hard. You know, the total world's economy is just shutting down and everyone being locked in their homes. And what that was doing for the world and the stress it was putting on the world's financial system and on dollar markets, US dollar markets around the world, they had to step in a big way. But they're now in this corner. They're in this corner of reversing course could be extraordinarily expensive for markets around the world. So they know there's just a very, very high cost to exit this position in, and they're only going to be exiting this position if they're absolutely forced to exit the position. So I think you're right. They're in a corner. It's a very, very difficult one to get out of it. The question is, will they need to get out of it? And that is a great unknown. And of course, there's a lot of bets going on at the moment that they'll be forced to come out of it. I'm not so sure.
Another aspect of things is the markets are beginning to price in a little bit of inflation. The trend over the course of the last couple of months or weeks for US Treasuries has been higher. They haven't necessarily been galloping higher, but commodity prices are also beginning to move higher as well. How significant is that in terms of derailing an economic recovery?
Well, let's talk about the picture, Tom. I think let's assume these viruses don't mutate in a way that undermines the vaccines. And frankly, I have no idea of the probabilities of that happening. But assuming we're on this path of vaccinating the world, even if there's a few delays, the stimulus in the world, and particularly what the United States is talking about with this third round of stimulus under President Biden at the moment that's likely to be approved, they're talking about $1.9 trillion, which is almost 10% of GDP. And that's on top of the 14% of GDP that happened under the Trump administration. So we're talking 23, 24% of GDP being injected into the economy by the government. And this is going to be coming at the same time that if we're on this track for vaccinating people and we don't have a major hiccup in terms of how the virus sort of changes, we're going to have a super strong back end to 2021, particularly in the US, but other areas, and I'd say through into 2022. And it's very predictable that with that big spike in economic growth, we're going to get pressures on the headline inflation numbers, and they could be quite high. So, you know, that's all in the viewfinder. I think it's incredibly predictable that will happen. But the question is whether we just see a spike of inflation on these reopenings and stimulus, or whether the spike of inflation that's likely to come is going to be enduring there. Most central bankers believe that this is going to be temporary or what they call transitory, that we're going to have a spike, but then quickly it's going to pass. The stimulus will fade, and then we're going to re-enter this world of sort of excess labor supply, all the issues that have been keeping inflation down for many, many years. And that's not going to change unless governments throw more and more stimulus at the economy. And if the economies are booming, it's hard politically to argue why they're going to actually just double down on stimulus at that point. So the central banks really are already seeing this event. They're already calling it transitory, this event. I think in all likelihoods, it is likely to be transitory, but that doesn't mean the markets couldn't move and bond yields start moving up materially as this inflation spike that's predictable occurs. People will start betting that the central banks are wrong in this view. It's going to be really interesting to see what the central banks do during that period when the markets bet against them. And my bet is that the central banks will double down, which is kind of making prisoner's dilemma worse. They will double down and they will either increase their level of asset buying, known as quantitative easing, or they'll do something called yield curve management, where they'll start effectively buying longer dated bonds to put a cap on how far they raise and effectively take the markets on in terms of this view that it's going to be transitory. We're actually not going to know whether it's a transitory inflation risk for a number of years. at the end of the day. But I think we're going to get this period where the markets are going to challenge the central bankers, and we may well see volatility as that happens. But certainly at the end of this year and beginning of next year, assuming something really adverse doesn't happen with the virus, I think inflation in the near term is probably coming. And you know, that's a very big debate in financial markets at the moment. But what the consequences are, you know, if the central banks are wrong and they're going to have to reverse course here, kind of hold on to your chairs. That is not a pretty scenario.
So, Hamish, one of the more counterintuitive outcomes, I suppose, in the last 12 months has been how consumer-facing stocks have flourished as much as they have. How do you weigh that outcome up in the context of what's going on at the moment, for example, against perhaps gaining more commodity-based exposure to hedge yourself against the prospect of inflation down the track?
Yeah, I would frame it slightly differently. I think what's really inflated here is what I call economically sensitive stocks. And actually quite a lot of commodity companies have done extremely well predicting this economic recovery post the vaccine. Travel stocks, even though travel hasn't recovered, a lot of travel stocks have done incredibly well anticipating that we're going to be traveling. Again, you know, banking stocks have gone up, assuming an economic recovery. Some of these are consumer names, but some of these are oil and gas companies have done very well in this period as well. So to me, it's really a bet on an economic recovery. There are actually consumer stocks, consumer staples have actually been one of the worst performing areas because they're so insensitive to the level of unemployment and everything else, they've kind of really got left behind this rally. So you look at consumer staples and saying there's an enormous amount of value there because they've been left behind. Companies like utilities have been left behind because they don't have any economic sensitivity here. So first of all, I would say that there is some real value in certain consumer stocks, the ones that are very insensitive to the economy, because that's not where people have rushed to. At the moment, how do you play against this inflation play? It's really difficult because if inflation is real, we're probably going to have a rise in bond yields and maybe a reversal of monetary policy. I mean, if it's enduring and real, and that's the discount rate of all assets. And once they put the brakes on, economies slow down. So, you know, if it really is inflation, commodities may not be a good place because they're normally correlated to the economies going strongly. And if the central banks had to move against it, that's going to force economies to go backwards. So some of the things you think are going to hedge you may actually be counterintuitive at the end of the day. Hedging yourself against real inflation, which would lead to higher interest rates in equity markets, is difficult, to be honest. I'm not going to sugarcoat that. We're giving that a lot of thought. We actually don't think, we think there's going to be volatility at the end of this year and there's going to be a lot of people playing around in markets on this view. I think it's going to be transitory, but if it's not, you have to be very careful where you're treading at the moment. And I mean, a lot of commodity companies have gone up a lot. So going into them when they've gone up a lot as an inflation hedge may not actually work. So it's difficult, but a lot of things may not work in that world.
And I suppose another challenge at the moment, Hamish, is the weighing up keeping some of your powder dry in the form of cash. And then obviously there's an opportunity risk that you face in that if you're not fully invested. How do you approach that challenge at the moment?
Yeah, well, we're fairly unique because we actually have two sub-portfolios. We've got a very defensive portfolio that's been in a real headwind. It has cash in it, but cash much less than it had 6 months or so ago. But it's got a lot of consumer staples and utilities and other investments. So a lot of those things have underperformed in the last, particularly the last 3 or 4 months. They've underperformed this sort of economic recovery. And therefore, if something goes wrong, they're probably going to give us a lot of protection versus what markets would do. And then we've got a growth portfolio. Over the last 12 months, our sort of growth portfolio has done terrifically well. It's interesting that people talk about, you know, what happened from November was a rotation out of growth into value investing. And I've never heard so much crap in my life. Sorry to use that term. What it was is it was a rotation away from defensive into economically exposed companies. Some of those companies were growth companies like travel stocks. Some of those travel stocks were growth companies like the internet travel stocks, and they went up 40%. What didn't go up was defensive names. Some of the rotation into economically exposed, of course, were classic value names, but I can't find many growth companies that have done super poorly in the period. True growth companies, they've held up very well, and many of them are at their all-time record share prices. It's defensive assets, and therefore not a lot of people are holding much defense in their portfolio, whether you say it's cash. Cash could be expensive, and don't forget I painted there three wide scenarios here. One, everything's fine, and therefore you don't want to take too much risk off, but you have to be careful about what hand you're holding here. I don't think you want to have all your eggs in the one basket, just betting on the low interest rates and the economic recovery, because there are other scenarios. As I say, inflation is not pretty to asset markets, and certainly a mutation of this virus that we actually haven't discussed, that's a real risk here as well.
So I suppose within that potential for mutation, there's not much room to move for the market on the top side. It all seems to be towards the downside under those circumstances. Is that actually the sort of pause that refreshes this market, given how far it's come over the course of recent months?
Well, will it be the thing that sort of causes it to pause or causes it to come materially down? It depends about what actually happens, Tom. And that's a great unknown with mutation risk. It's interesting that everybody's looking at this sort of UK and South African strains and actually say the vaccines are still holding against these strains. The South African one's a more worrying one because vaccine efficacy of stopping people getting affected seems to have dropped into the 50% level, but the vaccine defences, or the, let's call the fortresses, it's a very wide immune response, seems to be stopping people getting severely affected. And if you had read a lot of the scientific papers 6 or 8 weeks ago before any of these results out, I could have told you that was going to be the case to this particular strain, which is a mutation on something called the binder receptor domain and an area called E484K. And there were lab experiments done around that and said that you would get about a six-fold fall in the effectiveness of antibodies, but there would still be enough antibodies to provide a defense. And that's exactly what we're seeing. But what we don't know, and everyone's breathing a sigh of relief that the vaccines are holding, but what we don't know is what the next mutations are going to be. And there was a lab experiment that was done. And don't forget, this is just a lab, so I don't want to panic people because reality is different. But there was a lab experiment that was released at the end of December, a very, very interesting one. And what they did is they took the original Wuhan virus and they exposed it to antibodies in the lab. And for the first 30 days, the antibodies were totally effective against the original Wuhan virus out of China. And then what happened is it started to mutate. And around day 60 or day 63, believe it or not, in the lab, a mutation called E484K appeared in the lab, which is exactly the South African mutation. And in the lab, the antibodies dropped sixfold to that. And that's exactly what we've seen in reality. But 10 days later in this lab experiment, approximately 10 days later, and don't forget, timings can be very different, and we're pressuring the virus in different ways to what was happening in the lab, another mutation happened on another part of the spike protein that actually put a shield over the top of the spike protein, a very important part where it binds, called the N-terminal domain. And when that mutation happened, it was the insertion of some amino acids. All antibodies in all samples were 100% ineffective.
That's so a chilling
a total
outcome.
Escape mutation. So is that going to happen or not going to happen? Or are the vaccines, because that was done in convalescent plasma, that is different to what's happening with the vaccines in nature. Yeah. But these vaccines are going to continuously be chipped away at by mutations. And we've got the perfect experiment because there's so many infections happening in the world. And as you introduce more antibodies from the vaccine, you're giving it more environments to mutate against. So if we get an escape mutation, we're in a really, really interesting world. I would actually say it's a 50-50% probability we will get it. But then what are the consequences? Why I say 50-50, it's 100% this virus is going to continue to mutate, but it may well be these vaccines are so effective in their immune response that even when the, you know, the drawbridge is gone, but the walls are still holding, that, you know, as the turrets go down, there's enough soldiers that keep fighting it, yep, that even though it mutates, that we're still going to stop severe disease. I would say it's 50-50. But 100% it keeps mutating. But then what's the other 50% look like? 50-50 is just means I don't know. I'm not putting an exact probability. I'm not trying to get that thing. What are the other outcomes? It actually destroys the current vaccine's defenses. It gets around them. Then we're in a territory which there are two different pathways. One is that we can recode the current vaccines for what the changes are in the strain. And effectively, a lot of people are saying, don't worry, we'll just recode. And our scientific advice is it really depends. You know, this E484K mutation was actually a charge change in the molecular structure of it, which actually repels the antibody. So I'm not sure how recoding to produce new antibodies when the antibodies are repelled because of this structural change and other changes seen in the lab is really a sugarcoating change, which means antibodies can't see the virus. So, you know, there are chances that we can recode, and all that's going to do is delay, because if you really get around these vaccines, it means you have to go back and revaccinate everyone, because it will be the new strain and all the 85-year-olds won't be immune from it anymore. So this will throw off the economic recovery, but you recode for it. And the messenger RNA technology from Pfizer and Moderna is very, very good for recoding. But there is some risks that you can't just simply recode, and it really depends on what the mutations. And if we can't recode and the vaccines are no longer ineffective, we're kind of back at day one again. And I'm not saying that's going to happen. Please don't. That's what I'm saying. But it's foreseeable that this kind of thing happens. This is nature at work here. And people are simplifying this down. And there's just no margin for error at all in markets for taking this turn. And all people are going, oh, what a relief that the South African strain, that the vaccines still work. Well, it is a relief, but it's irrelevant.
Yeah.
Because we don't know what the next mutation strain is, and it's coming. And we just don't know whether the vaccines will still hold against that. This is a race against time and a race against nature. And as I said earlier, it's the year of living dangerously in markets, because everybody's got the bet on that the central banks have our back, we've got massive stimulus, and these vaccines hold. And that's the bet people have got. And they've actually got a bet inflation's not coming either. Because if you really thought that, you'd actually think very differently in terms of interest rates out there in the market. If all that holds, everybody's fine and going to make a lot of money. But if it doesn't, the hands people are holding could be incredibly dangerous at the moment. And I'm not predicting it's going to happen, but I can see this whole picture. I can't realistically put the probabilities on it, but we're being cautious about the type of assets we want to hold in this world where it's dangerous.
Hamish, I think that conversation was just an excellent example of examining the spectrum of risks that investors have to navigate. And sometimes they navigate that unknowingly, which is probably one of the more chilling aspects of the conversation. I suppose the one way that you can navigate the pandemic is by taking a very broad view and looking at the secular trends that are going to outlast the virus and have legs for generations. Magellan has been very good at isolating those. The migration to the cloud, I suppose, is one iteration of that through your investment in Microsoft. The other trends highlighted by your investment in Tencent and Alibaba. To what extent do you get some comfort by having those big names in your portfolio at the moment?
Well, we get a lot of comfort from that side of it. And actually that side of the portfolio, other than a bit of regulatory risk that pops its head up from time to time, those trends are incredibly strong, whether it's moved to e-commerce, moved to the cloud. Actually, we've picked up a large position we've made in Netflix, which is a fundamental change in the way the world gets entertained. And that's going to be a global oligopoly in time. So we're taking long duration views on those secular trends. And we're not that concerned about the virus one way or another, or interest rates, really about those sort of long-term investment trends. And, you know, we've got a defensive equity book that has been underperforming markets at the moment, and which is another part of our portfolio. And we actually feel really good about that. We feel we've got some real margin of safety in our portfolio for navigating this sort of uncertain world at the moment. And, you know, so we'll see what happens, Tom. But, you know, I think everyone should be a bit mindful of risk here. And you see extraordinary things that are occurring at the moment. And there's clearly, particularly in some retail markets, some bubbles that are just breathtaking. You know, Bitcoin's now worth nearly $700 billion. That's $700 billion of people's money. Tesla is worth $800 billion. So the scale of some of these sort of exuberance that's occurring at the moment, this fear of not missing out. I heard a story from one of my friends who turned around on Bitcoin and said that his 90-year-old mother is actually asking whether or not, in my opinion, whether she should be investing in Bitcoin now, because she's hearing from all her friends it's something they should invest in. The same thing happened to my daughter's boyfriend. Asked the question. He's never invested in markets in his life, but really thinks he needs to get on the Bitcoin bandwagon at the moment. You know, and those things worry me.
Well, I suppose this is where history can be quite valuable, Hamish. How do you stack up the Bitcoin question against the Dutch tulip bubble that we saw in the Middle Ages?
I don't think it's much difference. You know, you could have had, look, it was a very, very short ride, but look at GameStop.
Yep.
That was using a crowd. Effectively, they see a short squeeze, they then motivate a crowd, the crowd moves into something that had no underlying value in it at all, and you saw a massive bubble that got inflated, actually took a lot of money from people, and then it's deflated there. So, you know, so the question on some of these things is, you know, what is the fundamental value of Bitcoin? When the crowd is there and it's acting in a mania, it can go to ridiculous levels. You know, just what happened in the tulip bubble in the Netherlands all those hundreds of years ago, and then it turned out to be worthless. But, you know, Warren Buffett tells a very good sort of analogy, you know, of this. All these oil prospectors, they get killed in a massive oil fire, and they're all standing at the gates of heaven. And there's a guy at the back, and he's looking and goes, I'm never going to get my turn to get into heaven here. So he shouts out in the crowd, oil discovered in hell. And all the prospectors leave, and he gets straight to the front, and he sees St. Peter. And St. Peter says, well, that was a very sort of ingenious move to really test out your colleagues. But now you're at the front. Tell me why you should be led into heaven. And the oil prospector looks at him and he says, well, there may be some truth in that rumor after all. I think I'll go and join them. and you know, I think that's what's going on at the moment. You know, this is just massive. You know, one of our traits, which is good and bad, is a trait of envy. And people are making massive amounts of money. Some of it's just paper-based. By participating in these areas, and there's a mania, and when enough people are following a crowd in a certain direction, the bubble just keeps inflating. And then when they hear the story, people just feel that they need to go and join them. But when it unwinds, it can unwind in the most violent way if it doesn't have fundamental value underpinning it. And it just worries me when 90-year-olds and things are suggesting they should buy Bitcoin.
It's breathtaking in so many respects. Is it oversimplifying things, Hamish, to say that, you know, one of the biggest risks that cryptocurrencies face is central banks simply outright saying, you know, this is the accepted digital currency and it'll be overseen by central banks, not by ad hoc issuers around the world?
Well, I think that is going to be the end of private cryptocurrencies in the world. You can't imagine if they become large enough that any central bank wants a cryptocurrency operating in a way that's completely opaque, that's untraceable, can get around monetary policy. You know, when Facebook tried to have theirs, which was backed by underlying value, it was underpinned by a basket of real investments. And you can see that having more merit than something that's underpinned by a code in a computer with no underlying value to it at all. But if it becomes large enough and there's enough transactions going through it, you just think of money laundering. It's the ultimate tool for money laundering and terrorism and a whole series of things because it's untraceable on the distributed ledger and it undermines monetary policy and it could enable currency flows to happen around the world at a very rapid speed if it became very, very large. Is 680 or 700 billion very large? No, it's not very large, but you put it in the trillions and that type of thing. I think the central bankers, you could easily find the United States, the Federal Reserve, banning any American dealing in Bitcoin. And if they did that, what do you think would happen to the value of it?
Chances are the prices would be lower tomorrow.
I think they would be somewhat lower tomorrow. Is that day of reckoning coming? I would put a very high probability on that day of reckoning coming. At the end of the day, these digital currencies will be central bank digital currencies. They won't be private digital currencies.
Hamish, I think we have covered a wonderful gamut of topics over the course of the chat. It's always a delight to speak with you. We could talk for hours, but we'll have to leave it for another time. Thanks so much for your time today.
A pleasure, Tom. We certainly did a little tour around.
And if ever you turn your back on finance, I will be very encouraged if you pursue epidemiology as your second career.
We're still amateurs. We're reading a lot. We're speaking a lot, but we don't have all wisdom there, let me tell you, Tom.
Indeed. Thanks again, Hamish. Good to talk to you.
Thanks, Tom.